Welcome to Dominion Radio on CKDU 88.1. We bring you grassroots news from across the country, focusing on stories and voices silenced by the mainstream media. For more on the topics you hear about tonight, check out the Dominion newspaper at www.dominionpaper.ca. My name's Hillary Lindsay.
And I'm Stuart Neatby. On this episode, we'll be hearing a discussion about the Canada-Columbia Free Trade Agreement. We'll have a look at Canada's links with the late Indonesian President Suharto, as well as details on the secret history of the war on cancer. But first, Canada's Environment Minister John Baird is facing a lawsuit for his lax treatment of Irving Oil's proposal to construct a massive oil refinery in St. John, New Brunswick. The lawsuit was filed on behalf of the Conservation Council of New Brunswick and Friends of the Earth Canada. It challenges the federal government's decision to dramatically restrict its assessment of the environmental impact of the proposed Irving Refinery to the facility's wharf structure, ignoring obvious local and transboundary air pollution, impacts on endangered Atlantic salmon and right whales, and the global warming impacts of the refinery. Asif Rashid spoke with Taylor Gray, energy advisor with the Conservation Council of New Brunswick.
On January the 14th, 2008, the Conservation Council of New Brunswick released a statement publicizing that the Conservation Council of New Brunswick's Fundy Baykeeper and Friends of the Earth Canada commenced a lawsuit against Canada's Environment Minister John Baird over his treatment of Irving Oil's proposal to construct a massive oil refinery in St. John. I'm speaking with Taylor Gray, energy advisor with the Conservation Council of New Brunswick. So, Taylor, what was the motivation for this lawsuit?
Motivation comes out of concern we have for the environmental impacts arising from the proposed refinery and the fact that the Federal Minister of Environment did not follow due diligence in the environmental impact assessment.
If this lawsuit is unsuccessful, what's the real risk?
The real risk, lies first in this proposed refinery is another 300,000 per day barrel capacity, and this will have a huge impact on the Bay of Fundy ecosystem, and of course any potential accidents arising from the refinery. Any industry with such a capacity automatically triggers a full comprehensive environmental impact assessment from the Federal Department of Environment under Canadian law. Unfortunately, John Baird decided to only monitor and assess the impact that the wharf and shipping channels would have on the environment, leaving the province to monitor the impacts of the transportation of the oil as well as the refinery itself. And what we've seen in the past with provincial impact assessments is that they do the best they can, but they don't necessarily have the technological capacity to monitor the impacts of such a large proposed refinery. This lawsuit is, of course, asking John Baird to review his decision to only investigate the wharf structure and actually include the entire refinery. Hopefully this will be a precedent. There's two other refineries in Canada undergoing a similar review, one in southern Ontario and one in Newfoundland. Hopefully this lawsuit will also draw attention to that and make the federal government come to task on their environmental impact assessment and do them properly.
What was John Baird's explanation for not doing an assessment of the refinery itself?
The explanation was more so along the lines of just shared jurisdiction. As the waters and oceans on the coast are more federally controlled, they would take care of the environmental impact assessment for that region, but leave all land-based structures up to the province. It's an easy way to share cost between jurisdictions, as well as share responsibility and any potential liability. It's a very easy way to keep his hands clean.
So, in the past, what's been done? Is this a new move by the federal Department of the Environment to break it down, like you suggest?
Perhaps. There hasn't been any refinery of this scale built in the past 25 years, and this will become one of the largest in North America. So we're really seeing a precedent in terms of environmental impact assessments. I mean, this isn't something that, well, we believe that they're legally not allowed to do this. That's why we're launching this lawsuit against them. What we're seeing is something that could perhaps become precedent. If this is a very dangerous trend, if the Department of Environment at the federal level starts doing this with all proposed projects throughout the country. In other words, they're shirking on their duties as man-made environment.
And if the federal government didn't do the actual impact assessment, who would then?
Well, their claim is that provincial governments can do the impact assessments for all the land-based structures. But as we've seen in the past, in 1999, the current Irving Oil Refinery underwent some renovations, and the province did an impact assessment and came to the conclusion that there would be no increase in emissions. It did not present a threat to the environment or society in the surrounding area. And what we just found out recently is that, in fact, due to the renovations, benzene, a known carcinogenic, has increased by 63% in surrounding soil and air. So this just shows that the provincial mechanism for environmental impact assessments was not reliable enough for such a large-scale infrastructure project.
You mentioned the size of this proposed refinery, that it would be the largest in North America. Is that right?
It will become one of the largest in North America. It will certainly be the largest current oil refinery in Canada.
And what sorts of impacts would be on the horizon if such a facility were to open?
All the product coming into the refinery will be coming by sea shipping lanes. And in the Bay of Plenty, there is a right whale sanctuary, which is perhaps going to have to be moved to better navigate some of these large ships coming in. So they'll be unloading at a man-made wharf and a buoy pumping station. Whenever you're unloading oil products in a water-based environment, there's always the high risk of spillage, which of course would have serious impacts on the Bay of Fundy ecosystem. Apart from that, which I think are major concerns, is the refinery emissions themselves. You can't produce 300,000 barrels of oil a day without emitting serious amounts of greenhouse gases and other toxic substances into the air around. And this is something St. John's residents should be up in arms about, I should think.
So what stage is this lawsuit at right now?
The lawsuit has been served, and it's currently going through the initial process of informing the judge, informing all parties, and they'll all have, hopefully by April, the actual investigations and cross-examination should be underway.
Thanks a lot for your time.
My pleasure.
Take care.
You were listening to Taylor Gray from the Conservation Council of New Brunswick in conversation with Asif Rashid. For more information about the lawsuit and the proposed refinery, go to conservationcouncil.ca.
During the summer of 2007, Stephen Harper announced that Canada would pursue free trade agreements with several Latin American countries, including Colombia. The Canada-Colombia Free Trade Agreement has not yet been released, but there are clear indications that it will be closely based on the U.S.-Colombia Free Trade Agreement, which was voted down by Congress due to concerns over human rights abuses in Colombia. Gary Leach is an independent journalist and professor of international politics at the University of Cape Breton. Stu Neatby interviewed Leach in early December and started by asking him for a brief background of the Canada-Colombia Free Trade Agreement.
Well, with the failure of the U.S. and Canadian governments to get the free trade area of the Americas implemented by 2005, which was the original goal, both governments in the U.S. and Canada have switched strategies, and they're trying to establish bilateral free trade agreements with countries in Latin America. The U.S. Negotiated a free trade agreement with Colombia last year. Currently, they're trying to get that approved in Congress, and now the Harper government has followed on the heels of the Bush administration, and they're trying to now negotiate a free trade agreement between Canada and Colombia.
Now, on what grounds did it sort of get stopped on its way through U.S. Congress?
It's stalled now primarily because of the human rights abuses in Colombia, specifically the human rights abuses against unionists and workers in Colombia. The Democrats in the U.S. Congress have agreed to move forward on the free trade agreements with Panama and Peru, but will not move ahead on Colombia unless there's some serious commitment on the part of the Colombian government to address the killing of unionists in Colombia, where there's more unionists killed in Colombia every year than the rest of the world combined, and there's a 95% impunity rate with regard to those killings.
So I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about what the interests are for Canadian economic interests in the region, particularly in Colombia.
Well, the principal Canadian interest is mining, as it is in many regions in Latin America. There's numerous Canadian mining companies operating in Colombia, exploiting coal reserves and gold and other resources there. But there's also others. Colombia's got relatively developed industrial sector, so there's opportunities for maquila-style assembly plants. And there's opposition here, especially among unions in Canada, that are against this free trade agreement for the same reason Democrats are in the U.S. But the Harper government has started using the same argument the Bush administration's using, and that is that the decrease in the number of unionists killed in recent years is evidence that the situation is improving in Colombia, and therefore we should, quote-unquote, reward Colombia with a free trade agreement. But the reality is the killing of union leaders has intensified, because the dirty war of the last 20 years against unionists in Colombia has reduced the percentage of the workforce that is now unionized from 15% 20 years ago to less than 4% today. So while the numbers of union leaders killed annually has decreased, in ratio to the number of workers that are unionized in Colombia, the intensity rate of the killings is actually higher today than it was in the 1990s.
In the Maritimes, we have the distinction of having two power utilities that probably import the most Colombian coal than any other utility in Canada. You've been involved in a campaign to basically stop the importation of blood coal. Can you talk a little bit about that campaign?
Yeah, and this is already an example of how Canada's getting more deeply intertwined with Colombia around free trade. Neoliberal policies implemented by international institutions like the World Bank and the IMF have already opened up Colombia to foreign corporations, and as a result of that, Nova Scotia Power is importing coal from multinationals' mines owned in Colombia. And there's a lot of human rights abuses related to those activities. So the free trade agreement is just going to further intensify this relationship. Colombia is a resource-rich country. Its two legal exports, biggest legal exports, are oil and coal. And Canada gets both from Colombia already. That will probably escalate under a free trade agreement.
That was independent journalist and professor Gary Leach speaking with Stuart Neatby about the implications of the Canada-Colombia free trade agreement.
For decades, industry, governments, and scientists have known about the major causes of cancer, such as smoking, benzene, and asbestos. Yet they've done nothing to prevent these substances from being created and used, leaving people exposed to these and other known carcinogens. An estimated 40 million people have died from preventable cancers, cancers which were caused by things we know about and things we can control. Epidemiologist and director of the first Environmental Oncology Center at the University of Pittsburgh Cancer Institute, Dever Davis, uncovers this sordid history in her new book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. She documents how industry has worked to create doubt about toxins' health effects, hiring scientists, and suppressing science in their efforts to obscure the truth. The Dominion's correspondent, Andrea Smith, spoke with Dr. Davis.
So I just wanted to start with asking you a little bit about how we hear regularly of the escalating cancer rates across the globe. We hear about the merits of early detection and improvements in treatment, but what we don't hear about are that there are many known cancer-causing agents, agents that we've known a lot about for a very long time, and yet they have not been the focus of prevention efforts. And in your book, The Secret History on the War on Cancer, you document that scientists, industry, and governments have known a lot of useful information that could have saved millions of lives, for example, around smoking and benzene, asbestos, and other agents. I think listeners might be familiar with a little bit about the fact that tobacco companies knew that smoking was cancerous long before it was revealed to the public, but I was really taken aback about how far this history of an understanding of the major sources of cancer goes. Could you just talk a little bit briefly about this history and how it was buried?
Yes, I was shocked to learn that in 1936, the world's scientists met in Brussels, and they agreed at that time that their evidence was clear that benzene caused cancer. In addition, they understood the risks of diagnostic radiation and sunlight and coal tars and some forms of mining. And the reason that they reached that agreement was because they did not just consider human proof of hazard, but looked at the total evidence, including animal studies that were done on whole animals and even some experimental work that was done, along with the development of the very beginnings of public health statistics. And looking at all of that evidence, they understood the importance of trying to reduce exposures to cancer-causing agents in the workplace and the environment in 1936. In fact, the Germans and others understood the dangers of tobacco. There were reports in the 19th century on its problematic nature, but even in the 1930s, there were epidemiologic studies done that showed an increase in lung cancer associated with smoking. And yet, it was only some 30 years later that there started to be government recognition of the problem, and now we're still dealing with the consequences of the failure to act on that recognition some 30 years after that.
I was also really stunned in that history about the connections between war and medicine. You know, I think there's been some work that's documented the history of health and military research and how it's intertwined with World War II, particularly with Nazi Germany and American corporations. I really found it revealing that how the war effort drove prevention efforts down, and while at the same time militarization became the source of new treatments for cancer, namely chemotherapy. What was your reaction to this history?
Well, I was stunned myself to learn that the same people who had been doing the research on poison gas in Germany, that same work really, in an ironic twist, led to the development of chemotherapy. What they observed was that people who survived poison gas attacks in the First World War had almost no white blood cells. And they knew that leukemia, which means literally white blood, people have too many white blood cells. So they figured out correctly that if you could put poison gas into the veins of people who have leukemia, you might be able to stop them from dying of the disease. And the early research on this was, of course, conducted by the military because poison gas was a top secret agent, and it remained top secret prior to and during World War II, and was only published that they had been able to achieve success in treating cancer with poison gas, was only published after World War II ended.
Out of the use of chemotherapy and agents like that related to it, I know that some people have commented, you know, that we have a sick care system, even here in Canada with a single payer system. It's still a sick care system. It treats illness once it arises, and again, it doesn't focus on prevention. We do have efforts to bring primary health care here, but they are slow going. But even more contradictory than that is the use of carcinogenic substances themselves in the treatment of cancer, in the provision of health care. How do you think we can deal with these contradictions?
Well, let me be very clear. It may be a contradiction, but sometimes it's the only thing we can do. We can cure, for example, Hodgkin's disease in young people by treating them with radiation to the chest. Unfortunately, while we cure them of that cancer, they remain at risk of developing other cancers from the radiation treatment. So we understand that some of the things that we do to treat cancer can put you at risk of it developing later on. And as a consequence, there's a renewed interest in understanding how to use the immune system to treat cancer. And frankly, in Canada, there's tremendous interest now in understanding the importance of primary prevention. And that's why in Ontario and Alberta and British Columbia, I'm aware of efforts on the part of the governments there to require a right to know about materials that are released into the environment, and also to require purchasing policies that no longer allow governments to purchase things that are known or suspected of causing cancer, and ultimately give people the right to know about potential carcinogens in their environment, in their food, in their personal care products.
That's very interesting, because the right to know movement, as people may not be aware, has quite a long history, in fact, dating back to the 1970s and tied in with occupational and labor movements. Workers, essentially, dealing with chemicals and demanding the right to know what it was they were working with. That's something that I was thinking while reading your book and reflecting on a recent case, because it seems to be that there's this general reduction, decline in occupational health research in North America and elsewhere. And maybe not decline in the amount of research, but certainly in the prominence that it plays within public health. An editorial about the use of a chemical used to make the flavoring in buttery popcorn. It was by John Balmes, the director at the Center for Occupational and Environmental Health at the University of California, Berkeley. And he pointed to the fact that industry and government knew, again, that workers were being harmed as far back as 2002. But it's only once the public could be harmed that industry chose to act. So in many senses, workers are like canaries in a mine. What's your sense of this scenario?
Well, that's a very good observation, as you're well aware. One of the things people don't appreciate is that United States and Canada today have a smaller proportion of workforce that work in dirty factories and are exposed to pollution. And that's a consequence of the fact that we are much more highly mechanized. We use computers now to make computers in something called lights out manufacturing, so that they're working literally in the dark. But 20 years ago, we had women working in what were called clean rooms to make computers, and they were being exposed, unfortunately, at that time to agents in the environment that put them at risk. So the amount of exposure per worker has dropped on average. But unfortunately, there still are small workplaces where there are high exposures. And in the area of Sarnia in Northern Ontario, some of the highest exposures ever recorded to asbestos in our continent occurred to people there who were not mining asbestos, but were working in refineries where pipes were insulated with it. And as a consequence, the rate of asbestos-related disease in that population now is very, very high, 5 times higher than in the rest of Canada, simply because people there were working with a known danger. In fact, the government did not do a good enough job of warning workers about those risks, although people are aware of them at this time. And so you are absolutely correct. The workers have been the canary in the mine. And the case of the popcorn study that you refer to, the flavoring that's used for making popcorn, the dangers to the lungs of workers were known, again, some time ago. But it's only when the public gets information that companies under the current political regimens have been inclined to act. And I think that that's an unfortunate consequence of the way the system has evolved.
I think especially with the attention given to climate change and environmental degradation as a whole, it's really brought back the connections between ecology and humans' role in ecology.
It is important to realize that climate policy is public health policy, and the decisions you make about the type of energy you use and how you get it, for example, from the tar sands of Alberta, have an effect on the local population's health and ultimately have an effect on the greenhouse gas buildup that will be generated from the use of those materials as well.
One of the ideas that really struck me as well in your work, that consistently comes out, the theme of this mechanism for regulating chemicals that we have, both, you know, in the U.S. and similar, the regulatory process is very similar. And so it's this one-by-one approach to chemicals. I was wondering, can you just talk a little bit more about the problems with the current approach to regulation and testing chemicals?
The regulatory system that we have had in place in the United States and Canada evaluates compounds one at a time, in the case of pesticides, sometimes one crop use at a time. But the reality is we're exposed to things together. And I was stunned to learn that in 1936, one of the world's leading cancer researchers, Angel Ruffo, did work showing that sunlight caused cancer in rats, but that if you added exposure to hydrocarbons, like you can find today in diesel exhaust and gasoline, that you heightened the response to cancer from combining that exposure. And that's just, I think, a simple illustration of the fact that we live in a complex world and many of the exposures that we face can't easily be controlled. So our regulatory system really is not up to the task the way it's currently framed to look at these things. And that's why the green revolution in chemicals and in design and construction and disposal and energy really has to be understood as a public health revolution, because we're trying to use fewer dangerous chemicals, use them more efficiently, and capture the solvents and other things so that we ultimately have a smaller footprint upon the earth and less damage to our health. You wonder whether our criteria for how we get evidence in epidemiology might not be influenced by the fact that we've had heavy corporate sponsorship from the very beginning of many of these studies. And you go back to the 1936 conference where the world scientists said, look, we know that these things cause cancer in people because we've got good animal evidence and we have some human evidence. And you go to where we are now in the United States and Canada, where often the argument is can you show me that that gun fired that bullet into that organ at that time to give that person a cancer? And if the argument is framed like that, then we can seldom answer it, although sometimes we can. And as a result of the criteria of causation in epidemiology being framed in such a narrow and very stringent manner, it becomes almost impossible to prove that something has caused cancer until you have enough sick or dead people accumulated. And because cancer can take 30 or 40 years to develop, what it means is you've got to wait one generation in order to decide whether to protect the next generation. And I think that's the wrong approach from a public health point of view. We have to prevent harm, not prove that harm has already happened. In a lot of public health research today, we do focus on the how that cancer arises and how it's distributed and not on why. And that's one of the reasons that I wrote my book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer. We understand that it is important for science to look at mechanisms to understand how cancer develops. It's important for treatment, for example, but we've missed the boat by not addressing the issues of prevention. I think that Canada and the United States have to join the rest of the civilized world in banning asbestos.
That's very interesting. You mentioned asbestos. In Canada, of course, we are, along with the U.S., one of the last countries to still export asbestos. And I read recently that the Canadian Labour Congress is recently considering supporting a ban on asbestos. And this would be a new position for the organization. And of course, it reflects that it's not just industry, but it's also workers who have to lose from the regulation of toxic chemicals, right? So in this case, it was the concern that whole communities based on the mining of asbestos are going to suffer major economic implications of any move to further regulate the substance and close down the mines. So it really is, it does require a sort of a broader approach than government involvement, clearly, and understanding the nuances of all the players involved.
Yes, that's correct. And in fact, in the case of asbestos, unfortunately, in Canada, one in three people who develop mesothelioma, which is a rare tumor of the internal organs, of the lining of the internal organs, one in three people who develop this rare tumor, which is thought to be related to, uniquely to asbestos, has never worked with asbestos. And what that's telling us is that there are other exposures to asbestos besides those in the workplace. There's a general recognition now that asbestos exposures are causing health problems in people who've never worked with it. Again, Sarnia is an excellent example of this, where there are people whose only exposure took place when they hugged their mother or father who came home from work, and they develop mesothelioma when they get to be in their 20s or 30s.
Dr. Davis, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with me today.
That was Deborah Davis speaking with Andrea Smith about her latest book, The Secret History of the War on Cancer.
Ordinary man, nothing special, nothing grand. I've had to work for everything I own. Oh well, I never asked for a lot. I was happy with what I got, enough to keep my family and my home. Now they say the times are hard, and they've handed me my cards. They say there's not the work to go around. Oh, when the whistle blows, the gates will finally close. Tonight they're going to shut this factory down. Then they'll tear it down. I never missed a dinner, went on strike for better pay. For 20 years I served them best I could. Now with a handshake and a check it seems so easy to forget. Loyalty through the bad times and through good. Now the owner says he's sad to see the things have got so bad, but the captains of industry won't let him lose. He still drives a car and smokes a cigar, but still he takes his family on a cruise. to me such a cruel irony. He's richer now than ever he was before. Now my check is spent and I can't afford the rent. There's one law for the rich, one for the poor. Every day I've tried to salvage some of my pride, to find some work so as I might pay my way. But everywhere I go, the answer's always no. There's no work for anyone here today. No work today. And so condemned I stand, just an ordinary man, like thousands beside me in the queue. I watch my darling wife trying to make the best of life, and God knows what the kids are going to do. Now that we are faced with this human waste, a generation cast aside, for as long as I live, I never will forgive. You've stripped me of my dignity and pride. You've stripped me bare. You've stripped me bare. You've stripped me bare.
On January 28th, General Suharto, who was the military ruler of Indonesia for over 30 years, died at the age of 86. Media reports in Canada and internationally hailed the military dictator as the father of Indonesia's economic prosperity in the 1980s and 90s, while noting that he was also one of the most corrupt and brutal dictators of the 20th century. Suharto's invasion and occupation of the island of East Timor in 1975, for example, resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths. What has been less reported has been the close economic and military links between Suharto's regime and the successive governments in both Canada and the United States. David Webster is a member of the East Timor Alert Network and is currently a professor of international relations at the University of Toronto. He has traveled to East Timor on multiple occasions, most recently as an election monitor for the 2007 presidential elections. Stuart Neatby spoke to Webster from his office in Toronto.
General Suharto died recently. Now, he's been described in media reports in a variety of ways. I think the Globe and Mail called him the world's most successful kleptocrat, while the Financial Times of London claimed that he oversaw political stability and economic growth that pulled millions out of poverty. What do you believe to be Suharto's most important or essential legacy?
I think the Globe also called him a brutal dictator, which certainly 10 years ago they would never have said. So there's a change there. To me, the economic growth, if you look purely at percentage growth figures, yes, there was rapid growth at a high rate, and that reduced the poverty rate. But at the same time, it was a very uneven form of development that went on, and it collapsed suddenly in 1998, and you know, the growth was widely wiped out. And the income disparities grew under it and so forth. So if you look purely at economic growth numbers, then you've got a successful strong man governing a country with rapid economic growth. But if you look at a bigger picture, I mean, you've got the denial of human rights, the stifling of democracy. You have impunity for really crimes against humanity that go on not just throughout Suharto's period of government, but as the result, you know, crimes against humanity are what brought Suharto to power in 1965. You've got extensive corruption. You know, the UN called Suharto the worst head of state embezzler in the world by the time he was out of power. So, you know, massive corruption to benefit the Suharto family. And those are the biggest beneficiaries of the growth under the New Order, as Suharto's government was called. And you've got the particularly vicious abuses of human rights going on in some of the outlying territories, Papua, which was annexed by Indonesia in the 1960s, and then, of course, Timor, which was invaded and occupied in the 1970s for the next 24 years. So, I mean, to me, the successes in terms of economic growth don't make it justifiable to look only at that picture and take the human rights out of the situation. So, you know, I put these human rights issues, this wiping out of democracy issues, as the main things that are going on.
In terms of getting an idea of the scale of the brutality that occurred under Suharto, I mean, people have basically called him one of the worst mass murderers of the 20th century. Can you talk a little bit more about the invasion of Timor and what the occupation actually meant for the people living there at the time?
I mean, East Timor is a small form of Portuguese colony that they declare their independence in 1975 after a short struggle between the various political parties there. And within 10 days of the independence declaration, the Indonesian army comes in full force, bombarding from sea, landing in, you know, crossing the border and landing directly in Dili, the capital. They were, you know, enormous numbers of reports of, on Invasion Day, for instance, that people are being lined up on the wharf on the dockside, told to face the sea, shot and shot in the back into the ocean. There's extensive military operations. There's the killing even of Australian journalists who are on the ground. They're killed by the Indonesian army in the process of this 1975 invasion, and that. This targeting of the very small number of reporters there is one reason that not much was heard about it, because there was no one to report on it. The occupation itself, there's a very active military campaign from 1975 through about 1978, where most of the people have fled to the interior and are under areas that are governed by Fretilin, the pro-independence party in East Timor. The Indonesian army is realizing that what they said, we'll overrun the entire country within a day and it'll all be a peaceful takeover. And in fact, it wasn't that way at all, because the Timorese resisted very strongly, fighting back really actively. And the only way that the first phase of the armed resistance could be defeated was to go to the United States and say, we need more arms. And the United States turned out to be happy to grant those arms. So, you know, through this period of 3 years of really strong warfare, the people are prevented from farming, in effect. And as a result, you get a massive famine that aid workers were initially not allowed to go in and do anything about. So at least 100,000 people are killed in this period. Some estimates say 200,000 people in this early period of warfare and famine resulting directly from the warfare. And it's not till several years later that finally the Red Cross is allowed in, when one reporter manages to take a photo. Aid workers come in and say, well, this situation is the worst I've ever seen. Others say this is a situation worse than famine in Biafra, which was a big famine at the time. This is a one of the biggest humanitarian tragedies I've seen in my life. You see reports like that from the aid workers over and over again. And during this period, with the assistance of these American-supplied bomber planes, for instance, there's finally encirclement operations that succeed. Many Timorese are press-ganged into something that would be Indonesian army called the Fence of Legs, which is essentially making Timorese people comb a forest area. And their legs form a fence, of the idea that guerrillas will be encircled and not able to escape. And it's the mobilization of a civilian population to fight against those who are working for independence for their own country. So, again, you have human rights violations here. This finally succeeds in really encircling most of the resistance, but it springs up again in more guerrilla form and also in nonviolent form by young people living in cities controlled by the Indonesians. So this later period in the 1980s and 1990s, you see continued resistance by East Timorese people to the Indonesian rule. In response to that, you see from the Indonesians routine and widespread torture. You see arbitrary arrests. You see killings. The most famous is the 1991 independence protest when Timorese are mourning the killing of one of their friends, actually in a cemetery in the capital in Dili, and the Indonesian army opens fire on them in the cemetery. And this is filmed by TV cameras. Some people saw it on the CBC because there was a British reporter there who was able to film it and get smuggle the footage out of East Timor, and it was screened around the world. So, you know, for the first time there was visual evidence of atrocities going on. But although this was the first one that was shown on TV, it was not an unusual occurrence. The Indonesian army was using extreme force, including killings, on a fairly routine basis, and this is widely documented. You know, really extensive human rights violations running the gamut from the major killing to things like, you know, not being allowed to move freely around the country without a travel permit, which prevents people, again, from using the traditional farming method of living in one place and walking to their farms outside the village to farm. That was no longer easily permitted. You've got forced resettlement of people from the traditional villages into large resettlement centers or concentration camps, really, is what they were in effect. So you've got this, the whole range of human rights violations are there. And on the other hand, the continued determination of Timorese people to get their independence is also there, and that finally does win out in the end, but not until Suharto is gone.
Canada was also a supplier of arms to the Indonesian military, was it not?
Yes, it was. I mean, Canada is not generally known as the top arms supplier to any country. I mean, Canada tends to trail along in the wake of the United States in terms of that type of support. As I'm sure you know, there's the integrated arms market, defense production market, they would say, between Canada and the United States, and there has been since the 1950s. But there are Canadian arms sent to Indonesia in terms of military radio communications equipment, in terms of ammunition, in terms of aircraft and parts for aircraft that are sent. So Canada's not the leading supplier, but it is a supplier of arms to Indonesia, yes. In addition to the arms supplies, that Canada and Indonesia, it's not an important relationship before Suharto comes to power. I mean, Indonesia is an important country. You would have thought when talking about Canadian aid overseas that Indonesia would be a country that got some in the early period. When Suharto comes to power, less than 1% of Canadian aid has gone to the poorest countries. 99% of Canadian aid has gone to India, Pakistan, Sri Lanka at that point. Suharto comes to power, begins to stifle human rights and democracy in Indonesia. The Canadian response is to identify Indonesia as the first country outside the Commonwealth and the Francophonie, the French-speaking countries, former French colonies, the first country other than those two groups to be identified as a country of concentration for Canadian aid. And it's this aid connection that really plays out through the Suharto period. The more the human rights violations go up, the more Canada is not willing to talk about them, but will respond by increasing foreign aid. This aid, this foreign investment, these two forms of financial support together are really what keeps Suharto in power. Because Indonesia is not a quiet political society that everybody says, oh, Suharto's great. There's an extensive opposition. Suharto kills many of the opposition. But, you know, there's people who want a different form of government, maybe the restoration of democracy. Suharto is able to stay in power because he's getting, by the 1990s, for instance, $5 billion in foreign aid every year. Often Indonesia is getting more aid than it asks for. It becomes the darling of many countries giving aid. And Canada is leading in that area, in the financial economic support area, giving quite extensive amounts of aid. In 1975, for instance, the invasion of East Timor leads to not a scaling back of Canadian aid to Indonesia, but a big jump in it. By the late 80s, certainly by the early 90s, Indonesia is number two among Canadian bilateral aid recipients after Bangladesh. So it becomes really the darling of the Canadian aid destinations. And I think that's important to be aware of, because you have extensive Canadian support, whether it's foreign investment or whether it's development aid, that are going to Suharto. And that here, although Canada isn't a leading arms supplier, it is really important in giving forms of economic support. And those are important both because they allow the Suharto regime to thrive financially, including a third of that money being hived off in corruption to Suharto's friends and family, but also because it's a symbolic legitimization of the Suharto regime and a vote of confidence by Canada. So I think the aid is another important aspect of Canadian support that's really important to note, and that with the one exception of the 1991 when there's a massacre in East Timor, this aid goes up and up and up and up until Indonesia has reached a state of relative higher economic growth in the 90s. In fact, what you see is the enthusiastic Canadian support continuing regardless of the human rights situation right up until the end days of Suharto. Right up until the end days in 1998, you see Canadian companies continuing to look for new investment deals until finally Suharto is toppled by its people in 1998.
Now, I guess the other aspect of Suharto's legacy that deserves mention is the economic aspect. It's pretty well known that Suharto surrounded himself with sort of a class of economists, many of whom were schooled in Berkeley. They were known as the Berkeley Mafia. I think Naomi Klein, in her recent book, The Shock Doctrine, goes into detail quite a bit about the economic reforms that basically occurred under Suharto, particularly in the 70s and 80s, the rise of the neoliberal period. Can you talk a little bit about the effects of these economic reforms?
Yeah, but actually, I'd start by going back even further. The magazine The Economist referred to these economists who worked with Suharto, these technocrats, I guess, as economists with guns, because they didn't have much popular support, and the only way they were able to enact these reforms was to work with the military in the context of military dictatorship. But even before these people were trained at Berkeley, many of them got their start in the 1950s with something called the Indonesian National Planning Bureau, and this was a project of foreign economists coming into Indonesia to essentially say, this is how you develop a country. And these are some of the first development economists. And these are, the leader of this group is a Canadian. His name is Benjamin Higgins. There's three of the nine foreign economists on this board are Canadians. So there's a major Canadian role even before the economists are sent to Berkeley in setting, here's how you should be developing your country along Western capitalist stable forms of growth. And that's the real incubating past for these economists. So in some ways it's a Canadian contribution going back to the 1950s. And then they go on to study at Berkeley. And only after Suharto takes power are they able to come back to Indonesia and implement their theories in practice. These are open the country up to foreign investment, maintain a role for the state in directing the general direction of economic growth, but really to say we need investment and we'll do what it takes to get that investment. So you get foreign companies, Freeport from the United States, Inco from Canada being the two big early investors who are basically allowed to come in and write the terms of their own investment contract. So, you know, is this a miracle growth economy, as it was certainly being written about in the 80s and 90s? Well, you know, in some ways, judged purely by the numbers, yes, it is. And in other ways, if you look at the effect, well, there's a lot more to that story.
For most Canadians, the actions of organizations like Etan against Canada's involvement with the Suharto regime really hit the headlines in 1997 when Suharto came to visit Vancouver for the APEC summit, the Asian Pacific Economic Cooperative Summit, surrounded by protests. You were there at these demonstrations. Can you talk a little bit about them, how they were organized, and as well about the police response to the demonstrations, which actually occupied most of the headlines for several months in the Canadian media?
The lead up to APEC, I mean, this is Suharto's second visit ever to Canada. He came in 1975, about 6 months before the invasion of East Timor, and discussed it with Prime Minister Trudeau. But this was, rather than Suharto being new to power, in 97 he was a, you know, senior statesman, as they were saying, of APEC. The East Timor Alert Network and other organizations did try to say, well, you know, Canada has war crimes legislation directed against Nazi war criminals coming to the country. And Suharto is also guilty of massive crimes against humanity. And given that, should he really be allowed to come to Canada and enjoy government hospitality? So there were a number of things done. Etan invited a group of Timorese to come and tour Canada, and they took part in a kind of people tribunal to talk about the crimes against humanity committed by the Suharto regime. People informed the RCMP of the arrival of a war criminal, and the RCMP decided it wasn't going to be something they'd do anything about. And we asked the government to not grant him access and at least not wine and dine him as they were planning to at the University of British Columbia. And they weren't too open to that. And people also created, and this was what actually upset the Indonesian government the most, people put up some posters around Vancouver, around Ottawa, around Toronto, around other cities, saying with a picture of Suharto, saying wanted for crimes against humanity. You know, this was a time when international tribunals had been set up on situations like Yugoslavia, Rwanda, and so on. The International Criminal Court was being negotiated and being put in place. Suharto was a war criminal who was certainly somebody who should have been prosecuted, and activists in Canada said so, and they put up these posters saying wanted for crimes against humanity. The Indonesian government was furious at this, they said, well, maybe if this is the reception we're going to get in Canada, that Suharto won't come. Maybe Mr. Chrétien, Mr. Axworthy, the foreign minister at the time, we will not legitimize your APEC summit, which you're very proud of being able to host in 1997, by having our head of state attend. And that really worried the Canadian government because, you know, APEC was important to them. They were trying to push the whole Team Canada strategy of trade to Asia. They were talking about 97 as the year of the Asia Pacific. They were talking about getting a piece of the Asian growth for Canada. When there was this prospect that Suharto might not come, the Prime Minister sent a personal envoy, and then he sent his Foreign Minister Lloyd Axworthy to plead with the Indonesians, do come, do please come. We apologize for the fact that Canadians are protesting against you. That's not the way that Canadians behave. The people of Canada would love to receive you. We think well of you. Please come. The prospect of a government apologizing for free political expression by its own citizens and saying that this is not the way Canadians behave, when in fact Canadians are quite willing to raise human rights issues, whether they happen in our country or outside it, it's not the moment of glory, not the greatest moment of glory for the Chrétien government, not the greatest moment of glory for Lloyd Axworthy, who in other ways spoke quite well on human rights. You know, I think it was an embarrassment for the government that they did this. it goes on when Suharto does agree to come, and when, as expected, many people in Vancouver, including a lot of students at UBC, go out to protest the visiting of the university and the taking over of much of the university campus by the APEC Leaders Summit, the hosting of not just Suharto, like Jiang Zemin of China. Many Tibetans were very very upset about that and protested along with East Timor supporters. That protest was not permitted to go to certain areas, and as I think probably everybody knows, was met by pepper spray and forced by the RCMP because they wanted to spare Suharto, Jiang Zemin, and others the sight of anybody protesting against them. So I think it's an effort by the Government of Canada to deny that there is any dissent, there is any opposition in Canada to what was going on. You've got the use of force against Canadian citizens, and there was an inquiry about that, which came up with some very interesting revelations. But, to me, the fact that they didn't even want Suharto to see a protest was one of the most telling things about what happened there. They didn't want these Asian leaders to be exposed to the great shame of seeing a protest.
That was David Webster, a member of the East Timor Alert Network, speaking to Stuart Neatby. To find out more about East Timor and the legacy of Suharto, visit ETAN's sister organization in the United States at www.etan.org. That's www.etan.org.
You've been listening to Dominion Radio at CKDU 88.1. You can hear us the first Friday of every month from 5 to 6.
If you'd like to know more about anything you heard today or about more grassroots news from across the country and around the world, check out dominionpaper.ca.
My name is Stuart Neatby.
And I'm Hillary Lindsay. Thanks also to contributors and producers Pierre Loisel and Asif Rashid, who helped put together today's show.